We're here. All right, I'm here, Timmy again. Now with Isaac Scott and Sean Leonardo. I'm going to sort of pass it on to the two of you to contextualize. I guess we can drop the music. To contextualize how you two know each other, the work you've been doing together, which I know has been, at least for the past couple of years, in virtual space. So I kind of wonder how this continues that or changes it, but bring it where you want. I'll maybe chime in.
Sounds good, Timmy. And thank you for the invitation.
Of course. Yes,
Pastor and I are coming together as representatives of the Art, Justice, and Safety Coalition. And rather than get into overly organizational language, I'm going to invite you, Pastor, to really name what the objectives are. What do we mean by an interventionist practice, and what are our coalition goals?
Thank you. Thank you, Timmy, for having me here. Just to get right to that, we are here. The goal of the Arts Justice Safety Coalition is to support artists and arts organizations working at the intersection of art and social justice. You know, we have some principles that are really specific to changing how things are traditionally done in the nonprofit space and really opening up avenues for more collaboration, more of a nuanced use of the arts in a non-traditional way, and really just helping funders to better understand the need for the arts in all types of justice spaces.
That's perfect. And so we're going to hone in on one avenue of our work, which is specifically in the cultivation of and training around trauma-informed pedagogy. But before we walk through a few different exercises and offer some parameters around how to understand the work through those exercises, let's first just define the terms, right? Because we don't want to assume everyone is on the same page in the ways in which we might understand or define something like trauma. Quite often what you will hear, particularly if you only locate that word in popular culture, is this idea that trauma is a single event. And one of maybe the more relatable way of understanding that single event is that it is therefore defined as a psychologically distressing event that is outside the range of a typical human experience. Excuse me. Now, even there's a lot of variation in how you might understand that. But one way that we would pose this is that in the rarity of this event, there's something that occurs that gets lodged in an individual's nervous system that is difficult to metabolize. And I want to use that word intentionally, metabolize, in that the fight, freeze, and fawn, which is maybe a newer aspect to the response mechanism that might be newer to the audience, is something that's activated consistently and at a level that the body can't handle. However, we want to pose that trauma in this case, or in the way that we define it in this work, moves beyond a single event, and therefore should be considered something that is a repeated event. You think about a child that often hears their parents arguing, for example, right? But we also want to define it in terms of something that can be environmental and therefore indirect. You think about a young person that is experiencing violence around them, and that therefore there's the fear that they might be caught up in bullets whizzing in their neighborhood, or they might even be alerted to violence in their population because they have to walk through a metal detector just to go to school. And those sort of more subtle environmental impacts are something that is equally seeps into one's nervous system and therefore can activate them in a way that is, again, difficult to metabolize. So we also wanted to transition from defining trauma to further defining what populations that we work with and how, therefore, we specifically look at trauma-informed pedagogy in relation to system-impacted, folks, but even more specifically, formerly incarcerated individuals. So, Pastor, why don't you describe how trauma manifests itself in the population that we're talking about?
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to just really quickly thank you for laying out this continual definition of trauma and how trauma continues to take place and how it can and take shape in different forms. And it's not just one event, and it can happen over a period of time. It can be resurfaced. It can be re-triggered. It can sleep for a while and then come back. You know, so that is something to keep in mind. And that's a good segue into this section, too, because understanding trauma, it's important to understand, like, the type of trauma you're dealing with to the extent that you can. You know, we're not all medical professionals, so we won't be able to diagnose anything. And we're not suggesting anything in that nature. But it is important to know the people you work with, you know the population, because to that extent, then you can understand the types of trauma that go with the experiences that the population you work with experienced. But specifically, when it comes to understanding the population of incarcerated people and people who have experienced incarceration, whether that was a few hours or a few years, you know, the length of incarceration shouldn't determine, you know, the amount of trauma, because there have been people who have committed suicide in prison for short amounts of times, and others who have, you know, and it has prison and incarceration impacts each person very, very differently. But some of those psychological effects we should think about or consider when engaging folks who are justice impacted is one, a dependence on institutional structure and contingencies. So this may be, the dependency on the three hots in the cot, you know, and now a person is home and they don't necessarily, there's no one there to provide them those meals or make them go and do anything. And it's a different lifestyle, you know, especially if you've experienced long-term incarceration. You know, we have some folks who've experienced incarceration for decades, you know, so that sometimes there's a dependency on institutional structure. Hypervigilance. We also see things like interpersonal distrust and suspicion. We also see, like, emotional over-control in alienation, psychological distancing, right? We may see a social withdrawal and isolation. And we may see some of these things simultaneous with other ones, you know, maybe an incorporation of the exploitive norms of prison culture. So perhaps someone is, you know, maybe they're a little bit overly aggressive with a particular situation or trying to retrieve information or just something. Maybe they're just, you know, maybe they're at work and they're trying to pursue the answers to something, and they're just a bit more aggressive in their body language than everyone else is, and it's mistaken, you know. But in prison, you have to speak up, speak with your chest. You can't, you know, so it's a different environment. And sometimes making that transition from incarceration to post-incarceration requires some, you know, training and experiences, good and bad, and it takes time. Reentry is a forever thing. But also a diminished sense of self-worth and personal value. And this is a big one because when you're incarcerated, most of the times, you know, for a lot of people, especially when it's long-term incarceration, folks are abandoned, you know, left astray, you know, or maybe they came to prison and didn't have family members, you know. But on top of that, you know, this disconnection from the world and family and people, you have the officers who are there with their psychological foot on your neck, making sure you do X, Y, Z, this way, that way. And the attitude is, if you didn't want to go through it, you shouldn't have came to prison, you know, so that it doesn't help you to understand your life in any other context outside of, well, I made a decision, so I deserve this type of treatment, you know.
And as well.
So, you know, those are some, you know, and lastly, the one I would mention is post-traumatic stress reactions, you know, those are some things we can think about.
Yeah, I mean, thank you, pandemic. So in as you can imagine, in this list of potential manifestations of trauma, there's this feels incredibly difficult from the perspective of a teaching artist, of an instructor, of a facilitator, to prepare and to be able to be resourced in such a way that you might be able to at least meet a participant halfway or be able to detect what is occurring in the space. And that's really where the Art Justice Safety Coalition comes in, is executing and cultivating these trainings. And we use that word intentionally so that folks that are entering these spaces might have more of an awareness, more of an attunement of what's occurring in the space. And so we're going to really spend time on just two of the ways that we try to condition folks, and I say that not to adopt all of the agency or credit for this work. There's a lot of folks that pour into this practice.
But just before you do, just to clarify, when you said bringing people into this space, you mean after incarceration or while? I think people that are incarcerated,
I think it could be a little, we're talking about both, actually. Okay. Because when we're talking to folks, we're talking to people who are working in different types of justice spaces. So they may be working in a preventative space where they're working at cases where these are court adjudicated, what Sean is doing, right? Or you may be incarcerated. You may be going into the prisons working in group settings with people like Bruce is doing, the Phoenix Players Theaters Group. Mm-hmm. And they're up in Auburn Correctional Facility. And then you have post-incarceration group settings.
So just, again, to like clarify, it's really like facilitator to facilitator.
It is.
They're trainings for facilitating this kind of work. Yeah. With others.
That's right.
Okay. That's really valuable.
It's important because we have, everyone should have the opportunity to do good, but I think sometimes when we're misinformed about the issues and what people have experienced, the solutions that we may come up with may not be helpful. They may be more harmful. Hence the reason for the trauma-informed training for facilitators. Are you peeling back the layers or like peeling back a scab that was healing, things like that. So I won't go too far into that. So I think I'm getting ahead.
No, but that's the perfect segue because, what we find in a lot of this work is that the ways in which some of our practitioners are understanding the responsibilities, the accountability, the care in their work is contained to what I would call the material methodology. It's like, what is happening in the space? What materials are being used? What is the conversation? What are steps A to D, let's say? And so we're actually going to hone in on two different practices that move beyond this material production in this space. And so, Tim, I have a question for you just to kick off the first one. And again, we in cultivating the type of space, and we're using we're defining space broadly here. We're going to look at two different areas or aesthetics that might, again, condition a facilitator to be better attuned to what's happening in the space. So how would you, as a practitioner or teaching artist, how would you listen for trauma?
That's a very good question. I don't know. I really don't know. I guess, part of the difficulty in answering is maybe like I don't know if it's a cultural thing or a cultural sensitivity of not having a presumption. Right? So that's one kind of, and it's not like I don't think of it as much as, although some people might think of it as a threat towards one position and one's own position of authority or whatever as a facilitator, of like overstepping in some transgressive way. But I guess that is kind of the issue that blocks my ability to even think about how I'd listen for it.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that transparency.
I think the fact, Tim, that you can't answer the question is better, you know, because it means that you're coming to the space listening, you know, and the space can mold you, you know, and that's essentially a lot of what it is, you know, listening for trauma is more about, you know, the sort of attitude and approach we take to our listening, you know, when we're in these group settings, when we're facilitating, because a lot of the work is facilitated around discussion, right? And discussion on, you know, what people's experiences was, how can they get past them, or whatever the course and curriculum is centered around. But it is always in discussion with people, right? So one of the things we stress is empathetic listening versus sympathetic listening, right? Mm. Because the sympathetic listening only leads to like pity in people. But the empathetic listening allows you to kind of put yourself in a position where you can relate to what a person is going through. For an example, like if I told you that when I was in prison, you know, I spent years without a letter or contact from anyone in the outside world, and I felt extremely lonely. Surely you can't relate with being in prison if you haven't been to prison and being lonely in that way, but you have experienced loneliness. So when you hear me talking about loneliness, you can, as an empathetic listener, be thinking about, okay, I can understand your actions as it relates to you being lonely, because I understand how it feels to be lonely. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's a different type of listening, right? It puts us in a different type of place. Also, like critical listening, when we're really just like not just listening for entertainment, or, you know, it's no sort of biased listening, but we're really like thinking about what a person is saying. But also like in that critical listening, gathering information, like what is a person saying to me right now? You know, have you ever like had a person like take a long time and say a whole bunch of stuff just to get to one thing at the end? Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, that's what all of that was about.
Yeah.
So sometimes people just need to take that journey with you. They need you to journey with them. You know, sometimes, especially people coming from incarcerated settings, haven't had the opportunity to really speak to anyone outside of people who are going through what they're going through. So like, sure, it's good that I could speak to Sean if he's been incarcerated with me, but I would rather share with somebody who hasn't experienced it for a different type of response. You know, it's just human nature, you know.
Is that the critical listening? Is it maybe in some ways I'm starting to like create my own answers to what you asked me, but would it be in some ways listening? I mean, in my own work, I think a lot about the difference between for example, teaching being defined by the material that's being taught, or teaching as an activity. Mm-hmm. And in this case, if I think about critical listening, it's maybe listening to the way and the manner in which, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean stuttering, whatever else, although that could be, but I more mean the manner in which somebody constructs how to get somewhere and what they're saying versus what it is they're saying in the first place.
Yeah. The body language, everything that goes with it, you know, all of that has to do with our communication, right? Yeah, definitely. Also, like a good way of listening for trauma is just rapport building during the conversation, you know, and maybe sharing, you know, vulnerabilities help a lot, you know, leaning in. The more a facilitator can be vulnerable, you know, and show a correlation in some sort of feeling, it always helps, you know, for people to feel like, good, I'm not the only person. It's strange how we think that we're the only people who feel certain things. We think that about everything we feel, but everyone feels the same things at different points in their lives. And it's really good when you can get connected, or you just lock in with a person for a second and they just understand what you're going through. You know, they understand, or they show a little bit of a correlation between their life and your life and how it was some similarities. It helps in so many different ways.
Yeah, you know, there's something that you pointed out. Well, let's actually model it for a second, Tim. I want you to tell the audience present, what was one thing or one difficulty that you encountered when developing this exhibition?
Oh my God. One.
Just one.
One. The presence of my own work. And I mean, the exhibition was a conversation between me and Eden.
Okay.
But one of the most difficult things was trying to understand what the place of my work was in the show, and also like my internal battle of, I want this big thing that I thought was going to be in here.
Right.
And turning it into something else. And I guess maybe along with that, like trying to, you know, go back and forth between my conception of what the standing of my own work would be versus what somebody else coming to it seeing, oh, this is the curator, one of the curator's artworks here, and it's like the biggest thing in the room. So I don't know, maybe that's what there are many things. Okay. For sure.
So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, you were wise to think about the audience, but had you locked in with me,
yeah,
one thing that I was doing is just like sort of nodding head and
That,
which in many spaces, particularly with folks that might arrive with a mistrust, mm-hmm, that type of performativity might actually communicate that I'm not listening. Right? That I'm somewhere else.
Yeah.
Now, there's a few things that you said that, given the skill set that we're really trying to hone in on, I might really move into more firmly as a way to extract something that is going to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, in empathetic listening, what I'm really hearing is that this was a negotiation with yourself and your own ego.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
We could have that conversation.
Yeah.
I know what that's like.
Yeah.
You know, and you're giving us details, or you're giving us ways in which it moved mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, one of the essences of this conversation is like, oh man, I had to battle the ways in which I was sort of projecting myself in this space. Mm-hmm. That's a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
If, and just to give you one more example, because I don't want to take too much time. You know, there's an aspect in sort of information gathering.
Mm-hmm.
Type of listening where the conversation could be like, oh, well, what do you want to change about that for the next time?
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about how you had a conversation, mm-hmm, with Eden. You talked about how you had to make decisions as to placement, and like just being very specific as to these points of learning,
mm-hmm,
is where my information gathering fits in.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And that's a very different type of conversation. Mm-hmm. In both cases, I'm actually listening.
Right.
It's active, mm-hmm, as opposed to like, oh, I'm just going to absorb and like, oh, I'm sorry, that sounds hard. You know?
Yeah. So what would sympathetic listening be?
I don't want to. Just that.
Okay.
Oh, that sounds really hard.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I can't imagine what that might have felt like. Oh, is that how did you recover from that?
It's isolating.
Yeah. You know, and creates further distance from you and I.
Yeah.
So, along those same lines, again, we want to move beyond the ways in which we might locate trauma-informed pedagogy only in the steps of what happens in the space. And we want to take a moment to work through the environment in which the activity takes place. Pastor?
Yeah, so a few things there. When we step in space, it's like so much plays a part in the workshop itself. What are the aesthetics in the room? You know, how are we setting up the space? So I'm just thinking about the space. So I have every summer, I have a group of young people from the Summer Youth Employment Program that I supervise. And for 6 weeks, we do a community service learning initiative where we're doing a mixture of community service, and a lot of art, and it's a lot of digital filming and all sort of fun stuff, but they're learning stuff. So the first year when I did it, I set up the chairs in a circle every day, and it impacted the community we had, right? The next year, I didn't do the circles. And when I was reflecting on the year and improvements and some of the things that made it hard for us to connect with one another the way we wanted to was the tables in the room.
Mm-hmm.
because they would separate everyone. We weren't in a circle space where everyone was looking at each other and everyone was able to engage, you know. So just thinking about the environment and the impact that the environment has on people plays a huge part. The colors on the wall, you know, what color, you know, prison has these real saturated palettes, you know, where everything is just like real, you know, everything is just like grayish, tannish, and it's like no real life into anything, you know. So what rooms are you stepping in with people? If you're teaching in you're in prison going in, there's little you can do about the space, but you can prepare for it in how you engage the people who are in that space, knowing that the aesthetics of the room are not going to help you at all. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But in other spaces, you can bring people into a space that does a lot of the work for you. You know what I mean? And the work is done in the feel of the space. So now you just got to prompt people differently, and discussions and interactions will happen differently.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm going to do the same and sort of model this in terms of let's do it as a visualization exercise. But I'm going to save you this time, Tim.
Okay.
And I'm going to bring it out to the audience, and hopefully folks in the radio waves can follow along. May I target you for a moment? What is your name?
What's your name?
Oh, can you not hear me? I'll speak up. That's okay. Okay, sounds good. Because for us, we're loud.
We're,
you know,
very loud.
But so let me distance myself a little bit, and I'll project forward. And we're going to walk through this visualization for the sake of us, but also, and I will translate visually through language for the radio audience, okay? But imagine, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Sarah.
So Sarah, you are attending a training, a workshop. And the workshop takes place 9:30 in the morning. And you have an hour transport. You have an hour long ride to get to the workshop. And you are taking the G train, which is packed and the air conditioning is broken. The night before, you had a troubling conversation with your partner about future plans. And during the ride, with the air conditioner broken, you were confronted within, let's say, a 10-foot range by someone who might borderline be having a mental health crisis, but was screaming in your direction. Now, you have left the subway, and it's about a 10-minute walk is all you have. And you arrive at an institution, let's call it a museum for this workshop, and you're first greeted at the door by a security guard who asks you, why are you here? Now, you're then, after moving through that negotiation, arrive at the space. Tell me three things that might environmentally allow you to decompress for a moment before moving into instruction.
Okay. Am I engaging with anybody just yet or not yet? Just not yet. I can breathe. I will place myself in this situation and take it out of the other, take myself out of the train, which seems like a more triggering part of that journey. And I will remember to ask whoever I'm supposed to engage with how they're doing.
Okay, Sarah. Okay, so just for the sake of the audience, I heard breathing. So having a moment,
yes,
to breathe, maybe regulate yourself through breath. The second thing that I heard was an attempt to disconnect from the previous experience. How might you do that physically?
How much of it is physical?
How might you do that physically?
I would hang back from whatever crowd there might be.
Okay.
Maybe sort of enter it fresh, in the fresh mindset.
Okay. Okay. And then the third thing I heard was actually approach the situation by asking questions and actually asking another individual how they're doing as a way to have that rapport, as a way to have that exchange, right? All right, beautiful. Thank you, Sarah. So imagine this, and this is, I'm certain Pastor Nye will have experiences from an institutional level, practitioner level, but also participatory level, where those three things were not permitted. And what you might see, therefore, is, and let's locate this with a young person. So a young person who, therefore, and this is the experience of my own in diversion, where they're obligated to attend this workshop. So the first thing they're agreed with beyond the security guard, so there's already a level of mistrust and suspicion. And visualize this with me, right? You're entering in a space, and maybe the physical architecture feels enclosed and therefore claustrophobic. Imagine that. And maybe the walls are an off-white or gray. So the possibility of disconnecting from the subway experience all of a sudden is further compromised. And then the first thing that you're greeted with is sit there. There's already a mandate to be in the space, so you're given even less energy, less agency for a moment to disconnect and take that moment to breathe, right? And now I've also experienced or witnessed in these spaces where it's not only a directive of where to sit, but fill this out. And even let's say, even if I approach this with polite language, I need you to take a second to fill this out. I need all of your name. Do you know your social security number? You need to know your social security number. So even in the politeness of that language, yeah, I'm being directed immediately into not having any agency over how I enter and take a moment. So there's no recognition of the life that I've lived coming in. And then the third thing that you said, which was quite beautiful, is like, maybe I have enough power. Maybe I have enough regulation to be able to extend myself to someone else and say, how are you doing? So often, a mistake that we make in our pedagogy is, whether it's via an icebreaker or the way we come together, you know, is the first thing that we ask a person to do? Name and label. Tell me your name, why you're here, mm-hmm, who are you, not how are you doing? Mm-hmm. It's a grand mistake that we make in level setting. Mm. And so, again, I don't want to take too much time, but these are the ways in which we sort of try to create the space for folks to feel into what might be necessary in working with a system impacted. Mm-hmm. There's no tutorial in this. You know, there's no way in which Pastor and I or any one of our practitioners might give you the steps in which you can. It's about building the attunement, building what might be necessary in an awareness of what is manifesting in the space. Anything else to add, Pastor, before we transition to another exercise? How are we doing on time, Tim?
We have about 10 minutes
left.
That's
perfect.
Okay.
So in working with a lot of folks, what we have found, particularly, and this was most recent in an application process that Pastor and I poured into, one thing that we discovered is that an individual might have, and by individual, I mean a teaching artist, an artist, an advocate, someone that is entering these spaces really in the spirit of generosity, mm-hmm, that has a very strong pedagogical sense and really wants to bring a beautiful production to one of these institutional spaces. One thing that we find, however, is that they don't know how to talk about it, that they have yet to gather the language that would allow them to advocate for their own work at the intersection of art and social justice. So for these final minutes,
and again, when you say coming to an institution, you mean what kind of institution?
Let's specifically locate this within the prison system.
Okay. Okay. Not the Whitney.
Not the Whitney.
Okay.
And so there's a way in which their dedication to social change and their advocacy for what we've been calling the Art Justice Safety Coalition strategic arts engagement, its intentionality, its purpose, that they haven't quite configured the language that will allow them to illuminate what it is that they want to do in these institutional spaces, prison spaces, court spaces. The issue with that is so often we do need to convince the value, the essence of this work. And, you know, there's still so much, not only misunderstanding, but pushback in the value of arts in creating intervention in whether it's prison itself, reentry, diversion, the ways in which it can create and create rupture, but also elicit change in an individual or community or system. And so we're going to walk through another type of exercise to get to the essential language and illuminating what is important about our practices, right? Mm. And I think this could be applied to many different pedagogies. So again, for those of you in the room, I hope you can join us to sort of experiment with this a little bit, right? So think about how many of you, just raise a hand, are teachers or have some sort of instructor role, facilitator role in your life?
And there's at least two in here that facilitate things.
Facilitator, all right.
Curating,
absolutely, yeah. So I want, and I'm going to model this with you, Tim, primarily, mm-hmm. and you, Pastor. I'm going to model this with both of you. Imagine a facilitatory space, maybe one in the past, that you would define or experience or did experience as incredibly successful.
The space or the feeling of the space?
The feeling of both the space and your facilitation. Try to revisit the memory of a moment in which you said to yourself, damn, this just clicked. Mm-hmm. And it was like all of these things were working in connection. The way that you were attuned, mm-hmm. the environment, the exercises, the activity in and of itself, the responsiveness, the energy that was catalyzed, that it was all happening, mm-hmm. right? I'll give you a second to try to lock that in. And in doing so, I want you to think about in as much visual detail, what is happening in the space? What is the movement? What do you see around you? What is the light like? What are the colors? But I also want you to try to remember and re-inhabit the space energetically. So what was being said? How were people moving? How did that connection feel? What was happening in your own body? The sensations. Try to go there. And I know we're running out of time, so I'm going to give you only 10 seconds for that. I want you to distill everything that you're sensing in that space and in your body down to one word. Mm. That word should be an attempt to capture the essence, the value, the purpose that is making this moment, quote unquote, successful.
Mm. I got it.
What's the word?
Bees.
Bees. B-E-E-S?
Yeah.
That is so random.
No.
All right, hold on to it. Pastor, what's your word?
I think that my word would be more like collaborative or connection.
Okay, so beautiful. Now,
what about mine?
Yours was random. I gave it a descriptive. Now, take that word, discard for a moment the experience that you began with and really hone in on that word. Now, outside of your own facilitation, think of an art object, a media, an artful experience that reminds or connects to that word. So, bees, I'm sure there's a sort of metaphorical sentiment around that and connection or collaboration. Replace the word with an experience of art that is not your own. Mm. So maybe it's a book, maybe it's a theater piece, maybe it's you know, random artful experience on the street. Try to create an association with that art thing. Nod if you got when you get something. And hopefully you're following along in this phase too and on the radio waves. You got some?
You go, because I could describe it, but I'm trying to remember like the right version.
Got it.
I'm thinking about a drawing, not one thing specifically, but drawings that come out of the workshops that we do. And the reason I thought about that is because it's a process that we all engage in. I give a prompt, they follow the prompt, and there's like a working relationship throughout, especially because the drawing exercise is usually given to people who feel like they can't draw.
Love it.
So there has to be some level of like coaching them through the, and we're only drawing for about 10 or 15 minutes, but people are going in. And that the whole process is just so collaborative and connectional. People talk to the people next to them. And one of the prompts is look at your neighbor's drawings. Get some inspiration from the table you're sitting at. So now it becomes a group. You know, it's okay if I peeked that, I took that star off of your paper. So I didn't steal that. I got permission to use that star.
Right on.
So it was just a collaborative and connectional process. So, yeah.
Tim?
I think I landed on at least one example of it. It's they're a performer named Alex Tatarsky, and they're trained as a clown. And they had a show at Playwrights Horizons that was called something like, I'm not going to remember, sorry, Alex. But it like mixed, it was like Harpy Boy and Harpy Land or something. No matter, at so many moments in the play, you didn't really realize if you were a part of it or not in some ways, like if you were an acknowledged part of the play. And this, so the frame was sort of endlessly broken, but without the sort of fetish of a breaking a fourth wall kind of thing. Mm. She was just like looking at you. And also at the same time, their work is always like very maximalist. Like there's so much stuff, like any clown, I guess, has so many props and like endless stuff, but it kept oscillating in their work between like, whoa, there's all this stuff, and then suddenly like, oh wait, it all harmonizes. And then it's just like, wait, there's so many things, but wait, there's only one person on stage. How could all these things be animate at the same time? Those are my bees.
That's great. Okay, now we're gonna take that objects experience and replace that with a single representational image that is not necessarily a of the selection itself, so therefore it's not necessarily one of the kids' drawings, but instead visually encapsulates or translates the essence of that object or experience that you called up. So maybe it's something that represents or symbolizes the harmony. Mm. Maybe it's something that represents or symbolizes that group connection or sharing. Try to lock in your mind a single representational image. And we're past the time limit, so do it quickly.
I think about, because we do the workshop with adults and young people. I'm just thinking about like when two hands shake.
Okay, beautiful.
I like that. That made me forget my own. What was I just thinking about? I don't remember. Hold on. I guess there's some. Oh, I know. Well, it's just another performative thing, but a hocket, which is. It's a kind of singing with two people where you exchange note to note.
So what would the image be? Two?
Yeah, I guess it's like two, like a zipper.
Okay, interesting. Like literally.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, because it's at the end and the beginning. Uh-huh, nice. Okay. Now, just to close this out, One way to approach the final question would be, what surprises you about where you've arrived about that final image? And then more importantly, what words are now coming to you to describe the essence, the importance, the purpose as captured by that last image?
I'm like worried of the value judgments on it. I'll just go first because they're very, but if I think zipper, I think of like closing versus opening. I think of like locked in. I'm not like sure what I think of those things. I also am surprised that I'm back to something that has to do with two rather than many, 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 many.
Interesting.
Which is maybe like just a more manageable bees, but I don't know.
I'm going to come back and offer you something there, Tim, but go ahead, Pastor.
I think the togetherness in the process through the steps you just took, I didn't realize how much it really was a collaborative process that we were all going through to get to that final art piece, because that final art piece is a research piece for me. It's my way. So when we went to Cornell and we did the workshop there with Bruce, the prompt was create what is justice and safety mean without prisons, jail, or incarceration? You know, so that was our way of getting people to reimagine a world where you couldn't lock people up and you had to deal with what leads to a lot of the issues we see. And though it may be abstract in what people are putting together, it does offer a bit of information that can inform us on some real practical things and how we move forward.
That's right. Yeah. So what I'm going to end with and my offering to both of you is just to sort of articulate the journey that we just went on and be specific to the projects that you mentioned. Pastor, you began with this idea of collaboration, and you then described the prompt of inviting young people to draw and what that feels like and how they then start sharing. And what we ended with was much more of a prioritization on the togetherness that is formed in the space. Right. And what I would then argue is that in illuminating what it is that you do, that's the piece that can't be missed. That fostering of togetherness in imagination through art is ultimately the purpose. Yeah. And for you, Tim, what I would suggest is, while you began with this clown act, this idea of harmony that has many moving parts but somehow finds synthesis, what you're ending with is this moment in which that clown does in fact lock in with another individual. Mm-hmm. And there's an intensity and an intentionality of that connection being established. And so even in the metaphor
harmony
of bees, the bees at some point all do orchestrate one thing and become one form. And so that is the thing that you need to share.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Isaac, so much.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
I think we're gonna leave it there. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's good.
That was great. Thank you so much. I'm going to play a hocket on the...
Yes.
Awesome.
Say, to do, but shoot my mind.